I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, filling in for Ann while she's away this week. We often hear people describe themselves in terms of the animals. They'll say, I'm not a cat person, I'm a dog person, or vice versa. But does that simply state a preference, or does it tell us something deeper about the character and our outlook on life? So this hour, we'll discuss the connections between animal behavior and human relationships with Dr. Vint Verga. Dr. Verga specializes in veterinary behavioral medicine. He's a consultant for zoos, wildlife parks, and even everyday folks on animal care, well-being, and behavior. His new book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. Dr. Verga, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning, Mandy. It's nice to be here.
Great. Thank you for being here with us. Your book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human, is a collection of personal experiences you've had with animals and their families, and it delves into how these connections with animals can teach us how to have better lives, improve our character, our own personal relationships, and even enhance our spirituality in some ways. So, you know, I was thinking about this, and you had me nodding my head a lot in this book, but some might kind of poo-poo this notion, but you really believe this is true, that animals can, you know, can help us improve our lives.
Well, certainly, and I think it relates to the title, and it's particularly the subtitle of the book, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. The traits that we have as human beings, I feel, are commonly shared with most species of animals that live on the planet. And we have had, as human beings, this attraction towards animals, not only in modern age, but through the millennia, all the way back to our origins as a species. This attraction seems to be rooted in our very nature as a species. And I think what ultimately draws us to animals and what and the root of what we can possibly learn from them relates to our commonalities. What we do, I believe, when we seek out animals is we seek out a reflection of ourselves. We see an essence of ourselves within them. And in doing so, we want to learn more about ourselves and our relationships with them as well as others on the planet.
You said in your book, in the very beginning, that you had a special bond with your animals, maybe more so than the average person. So it seemed like veterinary medicine was a natural fit for you. But you noticed that as life happened, school, work, that connection with animals kind of drifted a little bit until the night you treated a Labrador retriever named Pongo that got hit by a truck. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about what happened to Pongo and to you that night that kind of helped bring back that connection that you're just talking about?
Sure. It was about 4 years out of veterinary school. I was working in Oregon in an emergency hospital. And as on a typical November night where we were dealing with an onslaught of patients, and in the height of that first wave of patients, Pongo was rushed through the waiting room, which was already packed with a variety of both dogs, cats, as well as several wild creatures that had been injured or were orphaned. And he was rushed back to the treatment room, which usually means that something pretty life-threatening is going on. As soon as I went to Pongo's side, what I saw was he was not much longer for the world. His gums were pale. He was very cold. He was non-responsive to anything in his environment. His owners were right there by his side, and he didn't respond to them at all. Yet nothing in my physical exam, his vital signs, our blood chemistry workup, x-rays that we ran on him, showed anything physically that we could find wrong with him. So with an onslaught of patients to treat, we stabilized him. I checked on him through the night, and and I attended to the rest of my patients. Each time I checked on him, the best I could say was that he was stable, no better for all of our care and treatment. And it wasn't until finally when we put the last patient to rest for in their bed for the night or sent them back home with their family that I was able to spend some real time with Pongo, more than just checking on his status and recommending what next treatment to do. He was laying in his run on a bed of blankets, and be honest, exhaustedly, I sat down next to him and worked on my medical records. And absentmindedly, while draping my arm on his chest and talking to him while thinking about what I was writing in the charts, what I noticed is in the following hour, his condition suddenly dramatically changed. And he went from a dog that was on death's doorstep, non-responsive to anything in the world, to in that hour licking my hand, nudging up next to me, and sidling up into my lap. There was nothing I did in that hour for him except sitting by his side, talking with him, and being with him. And that's what really transformed my career as a veterinarian and changed the focus of everything I've done since.
You know, it brings to mind young newborns who often are very, very ill and, like you say, on death's door. And, you know, mom goes to spend the last final moments with it. But during that, you know, those last minutes of touch, it somehow brings the, you know, the infant back to life, that human connection there.
Well, yes. And I think that's a beautiful example of how this is not something that is unique to human beings. It's something that we commonly share with other creatures on the planet. As human scientists would say, there's a theory. We don't want to go walk in a parking lot or in the middle, you know, on a sidewalk. We it's much nicer to go to the park or go out into nature and take a walk in the woods if we had that luxury. And the reason is we're seeking something. Out. We're seeking that connection, I believe, with other beings in that planet. And that same connection is what ultimately, I think, is what is driving what's happening in those vital moments between a mom and her infant, or a young girl and her dog, or an elderly man and his elderly cat that have shared the last 18 years together.
We want to ask our callers to call in. If you have any stories that your pets have taught you about being human, give us a call, share your story. You can do that at 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Verger, let's continue to talk about the connection between animals and humans. You write in your book that one half to two thirds of us consider our pets as family members. I know that I'm definitely guilty of this, not necessarily guilty, but I consider my little guy Jasper to be a part of my family. And, you know, we talk to them like they're our children. We let them sleep in the bed with us, as you mentioned in your book. And I'll say that it seems like dogs are pretty intuitive. I know that my dog seems to pick up on my mood, my emotions. If he thinks I'm feeling sad, I guess that's what he's thinking. He comes over and comforts me and puts his head in my lap. So what does this all say about us as humans and about animals?
Wow. Well, I think it says a huge amount. One thing I think is that it says that we communicate with and connect with other beings in a variety of different ways. And as humans, when I'm talking with you, especially since we're on other ends of a telephone, we don't get to see each other. We don't get to pick up on a lot of those essential cues that happen if we were side by side in the studio. But what I can say is we're picking up on intonations in each other's voices. We can pick up on emotions very, very well. Our animals, because they don't rely on human words, pick up on so many other senses and rely upon those senses in their day-to-day living. Sight, hearing, sound, smell, a touch, all play essential roles, not only in an animal's life, but in ours. What I believe in our time with animals we pick up on is we let go of some of that feeling or that we need to connect with others with our words, and we have to be alert and attentive to what we're communicating. And we allow ourselves to relax and be ourselves more intimately with animals, I believe, many times than we do with other human beings.
Dr. Verker, let's take a call from a listener. We've got Shay here on the air. Shay, welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. Yeah, go ahead, Shay.
I was just, I don't really have a story, but I was curious if you thought that it's always been thought that humans have an exclusively a sense of moral fiber or morality. And I was wondering if he thought that animals had a sense of morality, if not the same, but similar or different.
Yes, Shay. Well, nowadays in my practice, I work primarily in zoo behavior. So I'm working with a variety of species, from reptiles to what many would consider the higher mammals. And what I can tell you is certainly the individuals that I work with, while there are exceptions, the exceptions I feel are rare. And although it may not be word for word identical to what we would define as a moral fiber for human beings, I definitely feel that animals that I work with express in their mannerisms, in their actions towards others, in their actions even in how they conduct themselves in the world. They show a sense of consideration and deliberation towards their environment and towards each other that clearly to me demonstrates that animals do have what I would call a moral fiber.
You know, thank you for the call, Shay. In your book, and I'm glad that Shay called, because this brought up something I had planned to bring up a little bit later, is you talk about, you know, as humans, we may be conditioned to, you know, kind of tune out what's going on around us. We have so many choices, you know, what we're going to think about, what we're going to look at. Yet animals, you mentioned, they vividly, reflect their presence of the moment. And there was a particular bloodhound that you were talking about in the book named Murphy, who would act out aggressively, but he never hurt his owners. And what I gathered from that is you kind of theorized that this was his choice in the moment to take out his aggression on, whether it be a chair or some other kind of toy. He was choosing in that moment not to harm his owners or anyone else. So that kind of, I guess, kind of goes into that morality question.
Yes, certainly. And Murphy was one of the cases that still, even you telling me, just reaches into me, quite honestly, and really touches me. He's been one of the most amazing, remarkable animals in my life that I've had the pleasure of working with. And Murphy did have an aggressive problem. But what was very obvious, if you were there, you would be able to tell without a doubt that when Murphy became aggressive, he actually looked towards what he could do, where he could direct his behavior most appropriately without potentially causing harm, not only to his owners, but also anybody else that happened to be passing by on the sidewalk, whether it be a mom with a child or children running by. And he did that consistently over the course of month after month after month, without ever an accident of a single person being injured. A dog to control their behavior in that way, there's got to be an intentional mindfulness to their actions that was absolutely undeniable to me watching him.
All right. Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. We've been talking with Dr. Vint Verga. He's the author of The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Traveling and a living off the land. Me and you and a dog named
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, if I can get my name right, sitting in for Ann while she's away this week. This hour, we're talking about what animals can teach us about being human, and our guest is Dr. Vint Verga. He's the author of The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human, and he's a longtime veterinarian and animal behaviorist. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Verga.
Thank you.
Well, I want to talk really quickly about, you know, I was just saying what animals can teach us. And one story in your book talked about, I guess, a little bit about kindness. And you said that, when we reach out to animals, we embrace a part of our human nature that's as vital to us as our hearts and our minds. And that connection stirs our spirit to transcend the limits of what we think is possible. And you wrote this after talking about a cat, Prudence, who was a longtime family cat and one day just started behaving, aggressively toward her male owner. And to cut the story short, it turns out the cat had a brain tumor and wasn't just, had a reason it was behaving aggressively. But And the cat continued, to act out until her death, but her owners returned the behavior with kindness. And I think what you're saying is this is, another way that animals can show us how to be more human, how, to be kind, for instance.
Well, yes. And I think it's because of how we feel that we are treated by animals. We all talk to animals one way or another. And remarkably, the statistics show that 94% of us admit openly, and probably the other 6% just don't admit it, that we speak to them as if they are human beings, that they understand our words, or if not our words, our emotions and intentions behind them. And almost as many, more than 90%, affirm that our pets in turn respond to our human emotions, feelings, and moods. And I think that's at the essence of what you're talking about there and what I was talking about in that chapter. What I think, if we're talking about statistics, I think some of the most impressive statistics are to me that according to a recent survey by the American Animal Hospital Association, should fate somehow manage to leave us on a desert island where we're destined to spend the rest of our lives with one individual, more of us would choose a dog or cat than a fellow human, and I think that says something really remarkable, and even more telling. When asked who listens to you best among people that live with animals, the majority clearly state that they feel most heard by their animal companions. That when we're with animals, we sense their responsiveness, their attentiveness to us. We let go of our words and our agendas, and we slip more into the present moment. And being with animals helps us to be more aware of what we value most in our lives and to be more sensitive in our connections with other beings. That's where I think that we can learn a valuable lesson in terms of how we interact with each other by taking the same attitude that we take towards animals out into our relationships with others in the world.
I want to go to a caller from Clintonville. Beth, you are on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story. We've had a lot of dogs in our lives, and I've had home rabbits, Every one of them has their own little personality, and our second dog, Pepper, we had all kinds of animals growing up in the house, and one of them were pet mice, and she occasionally one of them would get out or just kind of make a run for it, so to speak, and she would be able to know which ones were who'd run away and just become feral, and the ones who had recently sprung the coop. And what she would do was she would gently carry around the tame ones in her mouth and then wait until she saw my mom and just plop the mouse down in my mom's hand and the mouse was wet and confused, but never harmed. So just kind of an interesting story. It just shows that they're smarter than you think. And I don't know how she knew the difference between, we never knew how she knew the difference between the feral ones and the well-behaved ones. And she always chose my mom. My mom has always had a very special connection with all of our dogs. And I just thought I'd share that.
Thank you for sharing that, Beth. Any idea, Dr. Virga, how this particular dog knew the difference and why it may have chosen one human over the other?
Well, they're picking. She obviously is picking up on cues that we're not with our human awareness. Dogs are all species, but just talking about dogs. Dogs are remarkably sensitive with smells to which we are totally oblivious. I think of taking my dog out for a walk. Each time she stops at a lamppost, I'm still to this day mystified. You know, what is it that's so alluring and captivating and fascinating as she sits there and analyzes and looks at all the different smells in her world? It's possible she's picking up on olfactory cues. It's possible she's picking up on cues just from the people around her that how they respond. Dogs can really focus in and respond in ways that we think are intuitive, and they may very well be intuitive, but they're also picking up on nonverbal cues from us that we may not even be realizing that we're expressing to them. They pick up on auditory cues and tactile cues. So it's hard to say what per se she's picking up on, but I have no doubt that she's being very, very sensitive and aware, as Beth had told in her story.
Well, kind of picking up those cues and staying on the same topic, we've got a caller here from Columbus who I think may kind of be on that same communication question kind of wavelength. So let's get Jessica on the air. Welcome to the show. Go ahead with your question.
Good morning. I once heard that dogs, when they communicate with humans, they look at eye contact just as much as body language, whereas when they communicate with each other, they focus far more on body language. And I've noticed that with my three dogs running around the backyard, they'll communicate just by running into each other and dancing around each other. But when they communicate with me, they'll tend to look literally right into my eyes. So I didn't know if that was something special that we share with dogs or if it was just something that they've learned to do, like through evolution, living in our society, that they've determined that that's the best way to communicate with us.
Jessica, I think it's actually both, and not even just from evolution, but also dogs are domestic animals, and we have selectively bred dogs for certain traits. So it's very, very likely that in among the traits that we've selected for through the centuries with different breeds of dogs, what we've also either consciously or subconsciously tried to do is select for dogs that seem to connect more visually with us, which to us, we relate very well to eye contact. But I also would say that what you also are talking about, Jessica, is that our dogs adapt, as does every species I work with. So how they communicate with a human being versus other members of their species versus even other individuals of other species, they adapt and communicate so that they can most effectively relate to other individuals.
We're talking with Dr. Virga, Vint Virga. He's the author of The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. If you have a story about what your pet has taught you about being human, give us a call and share that story at 614-292-8513 or send us a quick email at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Virga, I wanted to share a quick story about my little guy, Jasper, because I think it's a good segue into the next topic of mindfulness, which was really one of my favorite chapters in your book. Jasper and I were wrapping up. He's a 4-pound Maltese. four-year-old, five-pound Maltese. We were wrapping up his evening walk, and he was insistent on sniffing out a spot a little bit longer, and I was ready to get back inside. But I waited, and, you know, as I did, I happened to look at the park across the street, and for the first time in ages, noticed thousands of lightning bugs. I can't recall the last time I walking across the park and watching them until, you know, they pretty much had all disappeared into the night. And I don't think I would have done that if, you know, not for my little dog Jasper. So, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction of your book, that as life happens, we're running late for work, we're rushing to get the kids off to school, we're focused on getting chores done at home, we miss out on what's really going around us. And You noted that animals kind of tend to always be in the moment, so to speak. So can you talk a little bit about that, being in the moment, how animals are in the moment, and how we might could learn that from them to kind of slow down and sniff out the spots, so to speak?
Well, yeah, you talk about Jasper, and I can't even tell you the number of times that similar types of things, although I wish I'd been lucky enough to see that many lightning bugs. but I can't tell you the number of times that our dog and cat, or our dog, Katie, have taken me out of my thoughts of the moment, my worries about writing deadlines, what I'm struggling with at my desk, getting ready for my next trip to the zoo, and reminded me about what's important. I in my human limitations and fallibilities, I like everyone, get lost in my agendas and my thoughts, and so much of the time I'm living as many humans do, lost in the past or worrying about the future or somewhere in between, not even really embracing what's happening around me. And that, I think, is one of the places that animals have been the biggest lessons in my lives, and why I so many times enjoy and look forward to each trip I make to the zoo, each patient that I see in private practice, because they remind me right there that I've got to focus on my attention on them. I have no other choice. That is my job, and in doing so, they really help me to be more present in the moment. If we think about take ourselves out of the scene of our neighborhoods, you walking Jasper and the lightning bugs often in the park, and we take ourselves to a more wild setting, the African savanna, where there's maybe a herd of Grevy's zebra at a watering hole, and there's maybe a pair of rogue lions that are watchfully stalking them from the grass not far away. A mare, zebra mares, drinking at the watering hole. She's not lost in as she's sitting there sipping. Unlike you or I, she wouldn't be paying attention to, oh, well, what's my reflection like? How do I look today? Did I groom myself well? She isn't worrying about her next job review with her employer tomorrow, or about an altercation or disagreement that she had with one of the other mares yesterday. Nature and evolution demands that she be fully present in the moment. Otherwise, she'd just end up as prey to one of those rogue lions that's lying in wait. Evolution really, really demands of all species, or I shouldn't say it demands. Evolution favors the individual that can be most aware and sensitive and present in the moment. We, as human beings, are animals. Whether we want to pretend like we're not truly animals, that somehow we're some different evolutionary creature. When it comes down to it, if you want to classify us as an animal or a plant or a mineral, you know, we're obviously animals. Granted, we've evolved differently, but we still have the same evolutionary pressures. And I think that looking at the other beings that are around us, our dogs, our cats, Jasper, while you're on a walk in the neighborhood, or the zebra that we see at the zoo, the springbok that's standing on a rock in the evening, or a butterfly that's flittering by our faces as we get ready for jump into the car to race off to work, can all remind us about, well, wait a minute now, what am I doing right now? It's kind of taking the Buddhist approach to life of it's always about living in the present.
It's funny that you say that, because in reading that chapter, I did immediately think of a saying, do not dwell in the past, do not dream of the future, but concentrate the mind on the present moment, you know, being present. So I think that's something that we certainly, you know, can learn from our furry friends, and even not our friends who may not be furry, but some of our more slithering friends, which makes me want to bring on a caller who's been waiting for a couple of minutes. They have a story about snakes, it seems. Welcome to the show, Victoria.
Hi, my name is Victory, and yeah, I just had a story about my roommate's snake, actually. She has a pet corn snake, and I'm just always amazed at how much the snake likes my roommate's company and likes it when she comes home to play with her. It doesn't just seem like the snake wants to get out of her cage and, you know, slither around her room. She actually wants to interact with my roommate, and they're always teaching us in school and in science programs, you know, not to anthropomorphize animals, and especially lower animals like reptiles. But maybe your guest could talk about the lower animals like reptiles and things, and if you've seen much behavior with reptiles and the way that they interact with humans.
All right. Thank you so much. Dr. Virka, can you talk about that, about reptiles? Do they react like our furry friends, our warm-blooded friends do? Or are they as... Is there that innate kind of connection there?
Well, Victoria, I was smiling the whole time you're telling that story, right before I got on this show with you all. I was writing a blog post and for my Tumblr blog, and I was writing about a tegu. A tegu is basically a large lizard, and this particular tegu, Max, works or lives at one of the zoos at which I work, and I've only started to work with him in the past two and a half months, and I do work with snakes and lizards from time to time, but they're few and far between that I have that opportunity. And Max has really struck me with his incredible quick-wittedness. I would actually dare to say that he has a sense of humor in terms of the choices that he makes. He's definitely a very clever and smart creature, and he has a personality and an essence that every time I work with him, his easygoing nature, his patience, as I said, his sense of humor and his charm. Every time I go to that particular zoo and I see Max's on my schedule, I smile even before I've gotten to him. He's really been a lesson to me in the past few months, just reminding me that it's not necessarily just what we consider to be the most evolved species that are the ones that we can connect with. Reptiles all have individual personalities, characters, essences, and that is a fundamental premise I base the book upon, that it's not the soul of the higher evolved creatures, it's the soul of all living creatures that we have the potential to truly connect with and learn something from.
Very good. Well, we're going to take another quick break, and we'll get back to talking about those connections that humans and animals have and how we might learn from them. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, filling in for Ann while she's away this week. This hour, we've been talking about what animals can teach us about being human with our guest, Dr. Vint Verga. He's the author of The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human, and he's a longtime veterinarian. Dr. Verga, I wanted to ask you a question from a listener who emailed into us talking about dogs who've been physically abused by previous owners. And this email is from Lou, and they ask, do dogs actually learn humans are bad, or do they learn a response which can be undone? This caller says they have a dog which was abused, but they've had her for many years, and they still, I guess, have some aggressive issues with her.
Yeah, well, Mandy, the answer to that question depends a lot on the individual. Dogs and other species have a innate ability to forgive, to give as before, and to enter into relationships of trust and to develop trust with and rapport with people even after abuse and trauma. But there's a lot of individual differences and in variations. So if the trauma is very severe, if we're dealing with a dog that's particularly sensitive, it's entirely possible that even after months and years, they still could be the family that's living with that dog could still be living with the dog's trauma. Now. If we're dealing with an individual, though, that's holding on to that degree, then that's where I think that veterinary help can be really beneficial, and I would encourage them to seek the help of a veterinary behaviorist to see if there's anything they could do to help ease the life of their dog. Even aside from the aggression, it used to be, years ago, that aggression was considered in and of itself to be an entity and a behavioral a behavioral diagnosis. Nowadays, I would dare to say that aggression in most cases I classify as a manifestation of an animal being uncertain, anxious, worried. It's a manifestation of anxiety. And imagine if they're still seeing aggression after years after abuse or trauma, mm-hmm. what the life of their dog must be like, mm-hmm. To be on edge, to be anxious or nervous every day. So that's where I think we can turn to veterinary behaviorists for help and guidance about how we can help to make their lives have a higher quality and be less stressful.
Very good. Well, thanks for answering that question for our listener. We've got one caller who has an interesting story to talk about, so I wanted to get to Sarah from Pataskala. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Yes, many years ago, we had a cat at the same time we had our first child and noticed some interesting reactions. The cat was originally terrified of the baby, but eventually got used to him. She'd come sit on my lap while I nursed him and so forth, and inevitably he'd grab her occasionally and hang on to her fur, and she'd make a little distress sound and get real quiet, but she wouldn't scratch him. She'd also, when he started crawling, she'd react the same way. I saw him crawl right over her one day, knees, elbows, the whole nine yards, and she didn't touch him. When he started walking, then he started getting a little discipline imposed on him. He got scratched. I thought it was rather interesting that she seemed to know that he was a baby and should be allowed behaviors that an adult wouldn't.
Thank you for the call, Sarah.
Sure.
Dr. Verga, do animals, can they pick up on that when a human is an infant and may not know better? Because this kind of brings back to mind a family that you wrote about who had a little girl. They had two children before they had a little girl, and she was very, very interested in these cats, and one cat, you know, kind of gave in to her, and the other cat, it was very anxious and hid. So it would seem that cats would know, but do they know enough that, okay, this is a little bitty human, perhaps I need to be more gentle with him?
Sure. We see that with dogs. We see that with cats, and we see it with other with animals I deal with day to day in the zoo, not only towards their own babies, but also towards the young of others. So I think that that's a I don't want to say universal trait, but a common trait among species. With respect to the kitty I was talking about in the book, we were dealing with a kitty that was overwhelmed by a girl's extreme attentions. Little Mia just wanted to lavish her love on Sabrina every single moment of the day, from when she first rose to bedtime, except when she was away from home. And Sabrina was a very sensitive kitty cat. Persephone, the other cat that they had in their family, was a lot more easygoing and could handle Mia's attentions, but Sabrina was a different individual. Her personality, her awareness, what she could tolerate, just wasn't the same as Persephone. And so what Sabrina ended up doing was shying away from Mia and also everybody else in the family, and just tucking herself away and hiding as much as possible. Each individual that I deal with, that I come to encounter in my work, brings with them their own characteristics, their own identity, their own personality. And what we're basically talking about is each individual has their own soul or identity as a being. We can make generalizations about, adults tend to be sensitive towards babies in cats and dogs and other species. But we also can see where individuals are going to have different reactions towards the presence of a newborn. Also, I didn't hear from Sarah in her call how the baby was responding, but I did get to see Mia in the case that I was talking about with Sabrina and Persephone, and Mia was very enthusiastic in her attentions towards Sabrina. If you think about just the size difference, you know, if I had a big kid coming to me and going,
love me.
I might get a little overwhelmed myself too.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Virga, I wanted to talk a little bit about living with integrity. This was another chapter that I found very interesting. And you say that we as humans kind of restrict even our basic needs sometimes, that we neglect our relationships, our health, even our spirituality. But you say that animals don't do this by nature. Can you give an example of this? Talk about what you mean by that animals tend to live with integrity by nature.
Yeah, well, yes, I can offer an example of that. I think our listeners, what I would say first is that when I'm talking about integrity, we think of integrity as being in touch and acting in accordance with our values. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking about integrity, I'm talking about it in a more holistic perspective. It includes that, but it also includes being consistent with everything that we value. So in my life, my honoring my relationships, honoring my need for being creative, honoring my work, my sense of spirituality, my sense of connectedness with others, my health and well-being. And the way in which I look at my integrity is each of those different aspects of myself that I value the most, I look at as spokes on a wheel. And as I'm looking at my life and whether I'm in balance or not, I draw those spokes out depending on how fulfilled I feel in each aspect. And I look, you know, how round is my wheel? Oftentimes there's a good dimple or two in it. When I look at the animals that I work with in zoos, in people's homes, one of the things I look at in terms of their behavior is how balanced their life is. How fulfilled are they in the areas that they need to find fulfillment? Are they getting an opportunity not only just to come to a bowl and eat, but is eating, for example, which tends to occupy a decent amount of time for our dogs and cats' lives and for the animals in the zoos, is that something that's interesting and engaging, or are they just expected to walk to a feeding station or a bowl in a kitchen and just eat out of a bowl? Is their activity pattern fulfilling? Are they getting exercise? Is their health and well-being fulfilled? Is their interaction with others and their connection with others satisfying and fulfilling? The animals that I work with all live in human environments, whether it be our homes or whether it be a habitat in a zoo. Even the most fantastic zoos with gorgeous, enormous habitats for zebras and bears and giraffes, still they are not the same as their natural habitats. Mm-hmm. We are putting constraints on either a domestic or a wild being. And when we do, we can expect that we put constraints on their lives. If we turn to animals that live in nature, nature will put pressures on them. But actually, most of the pressures that animals experience out in the wild are probably a result, again, of humans and how we influence and shape their environment. Loss of habitat, pollution in the environment, predation or hunting and poaching, all are pressures that we've placed on them. But by their very nature, the zebra that I was talking about at the watering hole, or mm-hmm. the springbok gazelle on the rock, the grizzly bear in the woods, has an opportunity to express themselves in every way so that they find fulfillment. It's only when we put limitations on them that we end up finding animals that are not getting fulfillment in every aspect of their lives.
Well, and I think one thing that happens, and I may be wrong about this, clearly you're the veterinarian, but when we do leave them for long periods of time, that's not by their choice, and many dogs get separation anxiety. And I want to quickly go to a caller where we're getting toward the end of the hour, but I think this might be an interesting question that other listeners may benefit from. So I'm going to go to Jonathan from Columbus. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hi, I have a dog who has separation anxiety, but if my wife and I leave the house for 10 minutes and we come home, she reacts positively to us coming back. But if we leave for 5 hours and come back, she goes crazy, freaking out, happy to see us. I'm wondering how this fits with living in the moment. Doesn't that difference in reaction indicate that they are worried about the past or the future in such a way that they aren't living in the moment?
Thanks for the call, Jonathan. Dr. Verga, can you address that a little bit?
Sure. Well, Jonathan, I think that the answer to your question is yes, they are worried about the past or worried about the future and living in the past. But the other thing that you said that's critical, I think, in talking about a dog with separation anxiety is that they have anxiety. Separation anxiety is an anxiety disorder. And anxiety is not a logical, natural, behavioral response. Fear is responding to an immediate present stimulus and responding appropriately in a way that if it's potentially threatening enough that we take an appropriate action to avoid it. But anxiety is worrying about a perceived stimulus, whether it's real or not. So I see dogs with separation anxiety that are worried about their owners leaving well before the owners have left, sometimes even an hour before, picking up on cues such as taking a shower or just gathering their papers and books in the morning, well before they've walked out of the door. Those dogs are certainly not living in the moment. They're worried about either 5 minutes to an hour, sometimes even more from now. And what we're dealing with is individuals that are responding really out of context. These individuals truly have an anxiety disorder. Most dogs do not have, as prevalent as it is, or as common as it is, I should say, most dogs do not have separation anxiety.
Yeah, I know that my dog, he picks up on my routine in the morning, and he knows, and he goes to his bed and sits on it and stares at me. And I know he knows that I'm getting ready to leave. And I know some callers, or listeners rather, won't believe this. But, you know, I don't think it's, you know, gone so far as him being necessarily anxious. Dr. Virga, it's been quite a pleasure to have you on the air today. Thank you so much. Any final thoughts from you about our show?
Well, Mandy, thanks for having me very much. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to talk with you. If I could leave everybody with one passing thought, it would be take the time to enjoy and notice, not only from each other, but from the animals around us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to have you on today.